The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is my Cyber Show.
No, it's my Cyber Show.
No, it's mycybershow.co.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy.
You know, when I used to tell jokes at work, they called me the corporate commodian? That's because my jokes were full of...
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Fred here. Our next Angel to Exit members form is December 6th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.co. December 13th is our all.net community summit. We will be discussing all things cybersecurity. If you would like to attend live online remote, sign up to the mailing list at all.net. That's all.net.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news from the Cyber Show. According to the Slumbernitz Institute, last week's announcement that the world population reached 8 billion people proved their statistical result that humans never die. Updating their previous results, with 8 billion people alive today and only less than 10 billion ever having lived, the probability of a human being ever dying is only about 20%.
Now on to our first presenting company. Steve from AIR, how you doing?
Just fine and dandy.
So, Steve, tell us all about your history in, well, before you were in real estate. What?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I graduated from Cal Poly. That's kind of when I came to life. And anyway, I got right into real estate right away because I really didn't want to go work in the corporate world down in Dallas or anywhere. So I wanted to stay in the Central Coast and got right into real estate with my finance degree. I was a finance and property management degree. I like Cal Poly.
So what did you do in real estate? Did you sell real estate or get a real estate license or what?
Right out of Cal Poly, I was hanging around framing houses. We were, the market was going crazy. We were building houses and flipping them and all kinds of things. And I realized all my old contractor friends were getting into real estate after they broke their back and were worn out. So I thought, well, I'll just shortcut that system and get into the real estate business right away as a youngster. And of course, I had my HP 12C coming right out of Cal Poly there in 1982.
Why break your back when you can, break the bank?
Yes, well, I tried, believe me. But what was very interesting is I came out of Cal Poly and I knew how to do all this fancy calculator stuff. It was brand new, the present value of money in a balloon payment in 5 years and all this jazz. And of course, that was when interest rates went to 18%. So this was creative financing.
People today complain about 6 or 7%. Yeah. And when I was young, 12% was sort of the norm. It's astonishing the relative manner in which people interpret good and bad.
Oh, unbelievable. But it was a challenge. I was young and we were trying to make these things stick and creating all kinds of deals that were good deals and just trying to make them stick.
So did you get your real estate license?
Oh, no. That's when I first started. I got my broker's license.
So that was back in the 1800s.
Yes, that was back. That was
before the turn of the last century, not this one.
Before computers and copy machines.
Okay, so real estate before computers. How there were no computers? I mean, they just pieces of paper. How did they do it?
Oh, it was amazing. We had these little books that were published, every 2 weeks. And just the town that was 10 miles away had their own book for their old local association, and you had to either join both of them if you were selling properties in both markets. It was a mess. And this was before the internet hit. That's when my life all of a sudden exploded when I was building my office webpage. And before long, I realized, oh my gosh, I've created a little MLS system where the agents could input their own data and make their own changes. And
then wait a minute, you're rushing ahead. So you see your own MLS system. So were there other MLS? First of all, MLS is what, multi-listings?
Yes. Let me give you that. The multiple listing service is the MLS, and that's where the brokers share all of their listing data so that they can cooperate with each other. And it's a software system, this, you know, pretty old legacy systems, you know.
Well, wait a minute. At some point that came into being. Were you one of the creators of the first MLS system, or how did that come to be?
Excuse me, the first internet MLS system. So this is back in 1996. And, you know, what was happening is we were starting to email pictures down to my clients in Los Angeles. And I'm going, oh my gosh, this is great. Email. You know, this was brand new. And so we were starting to exchange real estate data. You know, this was the next step after fax machines. And pretty soon I decided, well, I needed to build an office web page. And I went down into the library, and away I went, and I spent my nights creating code and digging into source code all over the internet.
Right, now, when you say creating code, nothing in your degree here said anything about software engineering, computer science. So how did this all work? How did you start creating code?
I self-taught. I out of the books, and I got to the point where I needed some code that I couldn't do. And I got a hold of Mark Burgraff, who was our first engineer. He happened to be the local ISP manager. And so we spent the evenings and the early mornings developing the first phases of MLSToday.com.
What language did you use to code this in?
Oh, gosh. Well, this was .ASP before they really got to the market with that, active server pages and all this kind of stuff. Oh, we went through several different phases of that.
So what were these, Microsoft products or IBM products?
Oh, mostly Apple. Yeah, we were all an Apple.
Apple, okay. So you run everything on it. You had an Apple server, I guess?
We had a room up there in our floor of work, and we had our own servers there. It was, you know, a whole stack of servers. We had...
You got your own IP addresses, right? You got your own IP addresses.
Oh, yeah.
From Aaron, right? And
yeah.
Your domain and all that stuff. Okay.
We were doing some very cool stuff because we were one of the first ones to tie into the satellite pictures and be able to show a property and look down and see the trees and the house and all this stuff.
How did you get access to satellite pictures in that time frame?
This was Mark. This is my head developer. We were doing GPS stuff, and we were also auto-populating some of these forms that they were used. We didn't have the right to do that, but we showed that we could do it.
And, so you did it anyway.
Yeah, well, we didn't market it. We were trying to show that we could do it and then go show it, but the world exploded on us.
So, all right, we're going to talk about the world exploding on you next. So let's, okay. So, Chris, let's just give it a start here. I was doing email in the early 1970s, but of course it was the mid-1990s before the rest of the world started to discover it when the internet came out.
Right, and for me it was 1990, right, you know, getting on Usenet at SeaChange in Mississauga, Ontario. And think about that as I'm listening. Yeah, there's so many nonlinear paths. And it's not just the internet and so forth, but, you know, this is our topic, right? But, you know, people get involved early in something that then becomes popular. You don't get there because you took a course in it, because there were no courses. And coming from real estate, because, you know, I drove a forklift in a Sears printing plant for 6 years before landscaping my way into computers, right? And these things all connect over time. I look at my path and your path and our guest path. It's fascinating.
Yeah. So one of the interesting things that's sort of different now than it has been historically, for most of the beginning of the internet, it was all people who had done other things. None of them were trained in it. You couldn't be, because it didn't exist before that, unless you were on the ARPANET like me way back. And so almost everybody you encounter out there during that time frame came from something else, figured it out, looked it up, tried it out, and so forth. So they were a sort of explorers as this whole new cyberspace developed. And then it has changed, because now the so-called, well, you know, I don't need any experience, I don't need any education, I don't need any of this stuff, that's largely going away, at least for the corporate folks.
Oh, right. Yeah, there's so many interesting phases we go through, right? There's the, you know, Wild West analogies, right? You know, nobody knows how it's going to work. You know, everybody's walking around either with overconfidence or imposter syndrome, making it up as they go along, right? And then the, you know, anonymity on the internet.
Which doesn't exist, of course.
Right. But, you know, this the analogy to growth of a person is similar. You know, the adolescent stage where you have these utopian ideals. And I think right now we're sort of in the stage of shortly after that, we're a little disappointed that life doesn't have unicorns. But it turns out it actually works quite well. And I'm sure with, you know, this topic, real estate and the evolution and the adoption, we've all had some contact with it if you've been involved with real estate at all since the, like, 80s, 90s, and so forth. What's available, what's not available. Can I Zillow right in and see exactly where the property line is and everything else easily while sitting here on my phone, or do I have to drive down to an office and have someone open a book?
Right. And of course, this was the transition. Steve was the sort of the leader there at the transition between you go out and open a book and you go out to the internet and find it. So talk talk about the evolution of real estate in the internet and the evolution of cyberspace. This is a piece of living history.
Well, you know, cchudge.com was arguably the 25th website. I'm sure it was, you know, some higher number by then anyways, but there was because I copied page that was called all the web servers in the world, and there were 24 of them, right? So I saved that, learned a little HTML and made a website. I remember talking to somebody shortly after in that phase. I said, well, the web's going to happen. It's going to all these web servers all over the world going to happen. And just this, you know, knowing condescension, no, you don't understand. It's not going to happen. Why is it going to happen? Who's going to do that? And I'm like, everybody for all sorts of reasons. And trying to win that debate at the time, which I didn't succeed. And then looking back, it's like, yeah, everybody does it for all sorts of reasons. Real estate, hold my coffee. Could you imagine going back to the days where you have to go in to make an appointment to sit with someone and just to potentially see what might be of it? No.
And then 10 miles away, you have to go visit somebody again. Else. You know, my son bought his house in L.A. When he was at our house during the beginning of the pandemic. He and my daughter-in-law were here for almost a year at the beginning of the pandemic and had their first child here. Meanwhile, they're planning to get out. Because, you know, we love them dearly, but after a year, let's yeah. move on. So they bought their house in L.A. over the internet, and they did go once to visit it before closing the deal, but that's it. All the other decision-making was online. Not going back.
We're not going backwards. No, and I love the economics that drive these sort of things. This is a perfect example. This is not somebody coming at it because they want to play Dungeons & Dragons with their friends, you know, on a computer. It's business. What is the cost of buying a house when you have to fax yourself 5 different places, you know, compared to the way we do it now? It's ridiculous. We couldn't afford to do it that way. That economics, those sort of savings drive the adoption of all this stuff.
And now a word from our sponsor. Our next Angel to Exit Members Forum is December 6th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E. .co.
To get in touch with companies presenting on the show, you can go to thecybershow.co and look them up. Well, now, on to our next company.
Wilson!
Wilson! Chris, Augutera.
So Augutera, Land on the Water, is a company I started with Fred to capture the business value of the intellectual property around marine technology that I've been pondering about since 2019, particularly. So at this point, Augutera Electric Boats, our manufacturing subsidiary, is over the winter going to be creating its first commercial vessel, which will be self-powered, primarily solar-powered, and will be automated. So it'll drive itself around the water in the Florida intracoastal.
These waterways that you're talking about, not everybody understands the nature of this. So as I understand it, you have the ocean and you have the Great Lakes, and that's what people think about as the water, and you have big rivers. But there's a whole bunch of other water space out there. Can you just talk about how much there is and what kind of space that is?
Sure. In the continental United States, for example, there are 75,000 miles of connected navigable waterways. These are used primarily for commerce, shipping and so forth, a certain amount of recreation around population centers. And traditionally, historically, a very small number of houseboaters, there's an interesting little community that sail around and meet up at, you know, fascinating spots where nobody else is. And to your point, you know, the Great Lakes are enormous. There's lots of spots in North America, in Southern Ontario, for example, and Wisconsin, Michigan, various places that have a lot of lakes, a lot of freshwater lakes.
Yeah, but it's not just there. It's worldwide, right?
Yes, worldwide. And taking North America as an example, right? You know, so in North America, we have the intracoastal waterway, which runs down the East Coast, pretty well the entire length, and down to the end of Florida and down to Key West. And that's typically shallow water. So what Augutera is focusing on.
When you say shallow water, you're not talking about swimming pool shallow. You're talking about what exactly do you mean by shallow? What kind of draft are you talking about here?
What we're focusing on right now is known as literally littoral waters. And specifically water less than 2 fathoms. When a fathom is 6 feet, about 2 meters, we're talking 12 feet, 4 meters maximum depth.
So you're talking about that depth. So that's presumably near shore. There might be some islands in the middle of the ocean somewhere, but they have big waves. How small a draft can these boats that you're talking about go into?
So Mark Twain and Sam Clemens, sitting on Sam Clemens right now doing this call.
So hang on, what are they?
Mark Twain and Sam Clemens are the prototypes we've built. They were originally built on the water near Key West, about 80 miles from Cuba, and have been sailed a total of about 1,000 miles now together.
When you say sailed, you don't have sails, right?
Well, and it's interesting, the terminology often defines changes. Right now, you talk about sailing a boat, you know, you picture something with sails on it, or a big ship, you know, container ships, aircraft carriers sail out of port. You know, that's the terminology we use. In small vessels, we think of little sailboats and powerboats. So you don't sail a powerboat, you drive it. You know, you point it, press the throttle, go from point A to point B.
All right, your boats.
Right, our boats are self-powered. So I said earlier, they'll primarily...
Wait a minute. When you say self-powered, you mean the whoever's on the boat, but you crank it with your hands or what?
Well, it means they're not taking power sources externally. You know, energy is not being captured somewhere else outside of the system of the boats, and which I'll get to that in a second, but mostly each individual boat will capture its own energy. It'll do that. You know, solar power is a common way to do that, and we have a fair bit of roof space. So the boat that I'm sitting on right now, for example, has 3,000 watts of solar, makes about 15 kilowatt hours of electricity per day, and that will power, you know, all the living systems, pumps, lights, refrigerator, cooking, and propulsion.
All right, so there's a lot more to talk about in the power side of it and the energy side. There's also the ecological issues associated with it. We'll get to that, but I still want an answer to my question. How shallow water can you go in?
All right, you know, so that gets down to the artfulness of all of this, right? You know, so boats in general have been around for thousands of years. You know, since World War II, we've had a sort of standard class or sets of classes of fossil fuel power boats that behave in certain ways. And as we look at individual areas like the Florida Intracoastal that I'm sitting in now, for example, you see challenges and opportunities like anything. You know, the challenge of traditional boats is they typically tend to need 3 or 4 feet of water to be boats. And in this environment, most of the water is shallower than that. So there were massive dredging projects.
All right. So getting to the answer to my question, how shallow can it get and you'll still float your boat?
About a foot.
So a foot, that's like less than you usually have in your bathtub if you're taking a bath.
Right.
Right. And if you step off the boat into the water and you're wearing knee highs, you won't even get wet.
Quite possibly not. Yes, that's right.
So, and you can operate these boats, and that must be a vast area of the coast. We don't have time to keep going, but will you come back for the next show?
Absolutely. Yes.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Now, onto our first service provider.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round.
Ralph, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm excellent, Fred. How are you today?
I'm doing just great. So let's talk about quick. So, you know, finding funds faster is much more difficult than finding them 2 years from now. What's the typical time frame? You mentioned an example last time we talked about somebody, they had 2 weeks, the bank did a call, they called you up, and within 2 weeks, you had them paying off the bank and able to continue their business, right?
It might have been three on them because they wanted a little more. But I'm working on right now about a $7 to $10 million line, and it should be completed. The client was very motivated, so they got everything to us within a couple days. But I would say 3 to 4 weeks, that should be in place. The money should be ready 3 to 4 weeks. As long as, you know, approvals aside, I can't talk about it hasn't happened yet, like it has. But yeah, all things aside, I feel like it's very strong. We're gonna have multiple offers for their business. So
yeah. How about commercial lines? Do you also set up commercial lines? So if I'm selling things and I have lots of potential customers, but they don't want to pay in cash, they want to borrow the money to pay me. Because one of the really important things, if I'm selling millions of dollars at a time, you know, lots of people don't want to spend, you know, a couple million dollars right away, but they want what you have. So if you can get them a commercial line of credit, that solves the problem. Do you do any of that?
Yes, that can also be accomplished sometimes through the SBA as well, through government programs.
For a commercial line of credit?
Yeah. Huh. Some of the SBA products are for that. We have small nonprofit lenders who have SBA products.
SBA is the Small Business Administration, right?
Yes. And that reminds me of one of our other, when we have a multiple funding source, there is times where you can bring someone in first who typically locks out all your other lenders, but then you'll have nonprofits who are willing to come in for small amounts, term loans, $100,000, maybe $200,000 at the most, in certain instances, but that could provide that startup capital and then have invoice financing on the other side. So depending on the format of your business and how you, you know, build or distribute or sell your widgets.
Yeah, or you can have, if you have a B corporation, that might be one where you can even mix more of them.
Yes.
Because you have a non-profit component that can do one set of things. I like it. Very interesting.
You don't always have to be a B corp. to borrow from nonprofits. There's some small nonprofits that put out loans for like startup or certain emerging type companies who to basically create jobs. That's what the loans are for.
So Ralph, you know, you worked with me through Angel to Exit as well, A2E.co. Mm-hmm. And there are several companies there that are now with lines of credit or with other loans associated mm-hmm. with stuff you've done, factoring and so forth. And they've benefited from it greatly. And the reason I always want to talk to you about this stuff is because you're always straight and straightforward. And there's one other thing I wanted to say. I really appreciate the briefings that you give to folks that describe these things, because I've sat through a nice half hour briefing on factoring. And by the end, you know, including the examples, we understood exactly what we were getting into or not. That is just so important to have that, you know, somebody who you can actually believe and trust, who's explaining how it really works and actually understands how it works, including all the regulatory stuff and this sort of stuff. And there's another interesting thing. How about if we talk again?
Excellent.
Okay, Chris. So now we're starting to see there's a whole education process associated with money. And one of the really interesting things that I see in the larger environment is the need for and the tendency to help people get educated about finance and money when they're younger. And this is something we never had when we were young, right?
Right. Well, I remember, you know, learning how to do a checkbook in math class in like, I think, fourth grade, right? And it all seems so simple. You know, you just add up one side and subtract from the other side, but it's these fractal eddies in finance, right? So as we discussed in previous episodes on this topic, right, you can't know it all. You need to find folks you can trust, take the right risks, help you down that path, but understand it enough. You know, if you think about it as an engineer moving up the corporate stack, right, you know, getting less hands-on, what do you have to hack and to work with? It's the policies and process.
Yeah, I'm just so concerned about the extent to which you have to know so much in your life. When I talk to the folks on this show, every one of them that's being at all successful is talking about how much they're learning. They're spending a lifetime of learning. And if you're going to run a company, I don't think there's any choice. I think if you're not learning every day, you're going to end up just ridiculous and collapsing.
This is such a common cliche for me to say. Yeah, I don't know if I've said it on the show yet, so forgive me if you've heard this before, but we're moving more and more into the world where there's too much information to process. We all know that, right? This gives us the crux of an inevitability curve. You know, we will either in the future have figured out how to live in that world, or we will never be able to. We'll figure it out, but we're making a transition now. You can't know it all. Can't.
So, but I don't think you ever could know it all. I mean, maybe in the 1700s, right? But I think it's about who you know, but a different who you know, right? So it used to be that who you know is, you know, somebody, you know, that's powerful and rich. And right. Now the who you know is people that you can trust that give you good information about the things that you can't possibly be an expert with. And this gets to the community of expertise that you need to have around you and gets back to the issue of having good advice, right? This is what we try to do with advisory boards, is to try and get enough knowledgeable people so that we fill the gaps. And without that, I don't see how you can succeed.
Finance is like the advisory boards, you know, in each of these areas we look at, you know, in advisory boards, as you know, I feel very strongly that people are doing this kind of wrong. You know, we're doing it very 1980s. We as well fax the offer letters out to get advisors, but instead we need to do exactly what you just said. Have the right community around you, bring advice in as needed. And, you know, this is 2022. Things move fast. We're not bolting expertise in place. We're developing trust relationships and moving on.
Well, this gets to the social issues associated with the personality types that typically do engineering and science. And that's why it's sort of so rare to find an engineer who's also a good manager, who also understands the legal issues and can run a business. And by the time you're doing all that, your engineering skills, you know, can't stay as sharp as they would be if you were spending your full time doing the engineering.
Right. You know, and then swim downstream. Stick with, it sounds cliche as I'm, you know, or too simple as I'm saying it, but understand what you're really, really good at. Stay in that lane. Understand what you're not good at. And again, engineers tend to be smart folks. I have a little less tolerance for smart folks who don't see the flaws. You know, engineer yourself. What am I good at? What am I less good at? Where do I need help and advice, and where don't I?
And surround yourself by other people so that the group, the community that you form is successful as a whole and everybody prospers because of that group. So this is the opposite of what Ayn Rand talked about with sort of the elites being able to go off to an island and be successful while everybody else fails. It's exactly the opposite.
The last year out on the water sailing from the Key West up to Northern Florida, the people of value to me have been fascinating. Leo, the Cuban sponge fisherman, you know, living out on the water with his cute little dog Princess, the knowledge and expertise that he had, you know, is more valuable to me than any number of other things. So keep an environment around you of good folks you can count on. You know, this is a great segment to be talking about this. We're talking about money. Money is important. It's not that important. It's not necessarily more important than other things.
That's right. Well, now on to our next company. Mark from Firebug. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
anything new and interesting since we talked last?
Well, we're progressing along on what I'd like to say is not only we can stop half of all residential fires, they start on stovetops, so we can also now do water mitigation. So we can put a water sensor out underneath your kitchen sink, behind your refrigerator for your ice maker, your washing machine, hot water heater. And if you have any kind of water leak, we can pick that up in the first 2 minutes, send a signal to the property owner. We can send it to the management company and they can respond to it, stop the leak, save themselves thousands and thousands of dollars in water damage.
That's interesting because my understanding is when you talk about damage, one of the worst damage from fires is the water.
Yeah, I mean, you have a problem with the fire. Of course, you don't want the fire to continue because it would burn down the whole structure eventually. So we came up with fire sprinklers, definitely in commercial buildings and multifamily housing.
When you say we, not fire, but this was society.
Yeah, right? This is us as a general population, a general general need by all society. So it's built into fire codes. So you can't build a new building without it nowadays.
And, all right, but this water does. So do you know the numbers on water damage from sprinklers?
Water damage is the number one leading cause of damage in any kind of structure, residential or even commercial for that matter. It runs down the floors. It takes the units adjacent. If it gets an elevator shaft, runs down the elevator shaft, does even more damage. You can have 10 floors damage from one sprinkler leak.
Or from one sprinkler going off as a result of a fire, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, and that's what happens. They pay more from the water damage repair bill than the fire and smoke.
So. Interesting. Okay. So putting out the fires helps with the water, but now you're going to augment it with water sensors.
Yeah. If they just have a water leak, we can detect that too.
Yeah. And in an apartment building or a multi-housing facility of some sort, it's not just that. You don't have to automatically turn off a valve. You can call the maintenance person that runs the place and they can go turn off the valve and do it manually if necessary.
Yes.
Now, one of the big ones I had, and naturally in our house, we have every problem every other house has. We had a refrigerator. And, you know, the refrigerators are hooked up with this pressure connect of some sort. It's not a real, you know, real connector. And that thing, you know, popped off once and the water just starts pouring out onto your floor. And you don't notice it because it's behind your refrigerator until it gets pretty severe. So is this a case where you could end up with a sensor there and you can tell that that thing's going?
You would know the first 30 seconds of that happened. And you know where it's from because the detectors all have an ID. So you know exactly where the water leak was. And you could go shut off the valve to the refrigerator or the main valve.
Okay, so now in our house, we also have the sump pump. And one of my fears is the sump pump will fail and I won't know it.
Yep.
And if I could go put in a water sensor and somehow connect it up with wiring or something. But when Firebot comes out with these water sensors, then you'll be able to put them in your sump pumps and other places like that as well, right?
You are correct. Yes, we can do that very easily. And it's just a wireless transmitter, but we put a extended probe on it. And so when the water level gets to close to the top, you would know it and be able to address it. Okay.
Love it. Okay. So one other problem question associated with this water thing. I'm deeply concerned that you're called Firebot and you're going to start handling water. Are you going to get the URL for Waterbots online soon?
You know, we've thinking about trademarking Waterbot, you know, Firebot. But a funny story, we're talking to one apartment management company, and it's actually, he owns them. He's a builder. And he says that 47% of the apartment owners have a pet. And so we're thinking, well, rather than Lowe's or Home Depot, maybe we ought to sell Firebots out of a pet store because pet owners are very conscientious of their pets. I mean,
absolutely. I've seen people, you know, people have run into their homes and died trying to save their pets.
Exactly. So we're thinking we'll sell them there, but we'll recall it Furbot versus Firebot.
A whole line of things that end in bot. All right. Fantastic. Mark, it's great to talk to you. It's great to have fun, especially. So what do you think about the Furbot?
Sensor all the things. And I have a story to share about this one. You know, my mom and her husband went on vacation or left the house for a week or two. And the ice maker in the fridge, one-story house with a finished basement, the ice maker in the fridge, the little hose, the back, that thin little water hose came out. And it ran for a week or so. And it was $70,000 worth of damage.
I'm sorry, $70,000?
$70,000 worth of damage, right?
Oh, my. Okay, yeah. So just having the ability to detect this. You need somebody to go to the house and shut it off. Oh, you shut off the water outside if you have to.
Yeah. Would you like to know? Would you like to not know that tiny little hose just came off? So, yes.
Oh, my
goodness. All the bloody things.
Yeah. There's, where I live, water is quite expensive. And we've had cases where people have had toilets run when they go on vacation and they come back and the toilet running has cost them tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I can see it. Yep.
That's just the water cost. So now, fortunately, that was all just going through the drain. So they didn't have the other side effects of that. Water is sort of the most pernicious thing in houses, the most damaging thing. I love the idea that you get, it's not just alarms, right? So now you have alarms and you have response processes because, the alarms in houses right now that you're required to have, they just sound the alarm to get you out. They don't call the fire department. And if you have a CO2 alarm or whatever, it's the same thing. They sound off to warn you, but there's no response. And one of the fundamental things that Mark understood when he started that business and when he came up with the concept was it's not just detection. Detection without response is meaningless. So he's looking at that cycle, the detect and respond, react to it to temporarily fix the problem so that you limit the damage before the bad things happen. Well, good gracious, there's got to be 1,000 things like this where just the fact that we can detect it and ignore the response, that's a huge gap. There's an enormous business opportunity for cybernetic systems across the board to do this.
Well, we have smart cars that know everything that's going on around them. We have a 5-year-old car with blind spot detection, all these other things, that knows what's going on in the world around it. But, because we want that, because, we want our cars to be safe because we're inside them. Smart homes, this is, again, one of these things that takes a long time to inch into. But, smart lights and all these other wonderful things are great. But I want my home to be smart enough to know that, I might die in a second and do something about it.
Save you. Yeah, of course. Why not?
Right.
Same with your boat.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. We all agree. And by the way, this goes to the long-term theme that we've discussed many times. And that is that the world is getting better. We have all these problems that we associate with cyber because you and I work in cybersecurity for so long. But the reality is people are living longer, healthier, better, happier, more fruitful lives because of the advances in cyber technology.
And it's just begun. I look around the world and I see things. Again, I agree with you. Happier to be living now than if it was 1922. Or 1822, or God help us, 1422, right? We're still doing things very primitively. I look at agriculture and we make 30% more food per person with 8 billion people than we did with 3 billion. However,
we're
still mostly just throwing seeds in the mud and hoping it rains.
That's changing too. And we're going to have a company that you're going to discuss this with before too long called PowerGrow that is changing that as well.
Efficiencies everywhere. Lots of room to grow.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Our next Angel to Exit Members Forum is December 6th. Join the mailing list at a2e.co for details. That's the letter A, the number 2, the letter E.co.
Frauds, spies, and lies, and how to defeat them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. One of the classic scams is called the honey trap. The honey trap is where some honey, male or female, comes on to you over the internet with an offer of some sort. Now, there are lots of ways to figure out that this is a fraud. The first one is I'm in my mid to late 60s, and here we have a young woman saying that she's going to be highly attracted to me because she's looking for a soulmate. But, frankly, I should know better, and I do, but you should know better too. So here's the email I got sent to an info account, not even sent to a personal account, so it's pretty easy to detect in this case, with pictures. So in this case, there are 5 pictures, each of what appears to be a different person, each with different hair color, different looks, different uniforms, and so forth.
My name is
blah, blah.
I'm a Polish lady from Poland, but I live in London.
And so forth. And
I work on an oil tanker. I'm looking for a soulmate. Please, if you are interested in becoming one, kindly reply to me, then we can proceed further. You can find attached to this mail my pictures. I will send you more if we get to know each other better.
Naturally, it's some random email address not associated with the name at a Hotmail account or a Gmail account or whatever. It's not one associated with the work that she claims to be in, and so forth. The last thing to note is she wants my WhatsApp number.
Kindly give me your WhatsApp number so that we can keep chatting more.
Now, the thing about WhatsApp, this is sort of the most common places that I
see people coming with scams to try and solicit me. I find they all want to get a WhatsApp account. And the reason for this, I suspect, is that WhatsApp has vulnerabilities. I disabled it from my cell phone some time ago because I found that it was gaining access to things it shouldn't have access to. One other thing to note, I have more than one email account. So I see these email messages with identical content, identical pictures, and so forth being sent to multiple accounts. As a result, I know it can't in any way be personal to me, of course. So that's just one example of the honey trap, in this case, in email. Honey traps aren't limited to just email, of course. This is an example from LinkedIn.
Hello, I hope my invitation will make your life and work happy and fulfilling.
The next message, when I didn't respond right away, like 2 minutes later.
Sir, are you still busy? You seem to be a very mature and successful person. I find the light of wisdom in your eyes and hope to have a pleasant conversation with you.
And so forth, right? So I probably have had 20 of those in the last month from different, apparently female, usually with a Chinese name, usually with a nexus in California where I live.
Do you live in California too?
Usually coming to visit relatives in the next few weeks and would love to have coffee with me or visit me at my house. Again, it's the same thing, and I've been through lots and lots of these, and I try to have discussions with them to try and understand what they're trying to accomplish and so forth, but I would advise you against it. So when somebody says, hi, I'm your friend, I'd really love to meet you, you sound fascinating to me, and they appear to be a young woman from China, and they're just ready to have lunch with you in your neighborhood, probably, it's a honey trap. Every week, we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books.
The Cyber Show is brought to you by Waves, in the air and in space.
We have Hank on the show today. Hank is a lawyer, but not a liar. Hank, how are you doing today?
Very well, Fred. How are you doing?
I'm doing just great. So you've been a lawyer in Silicon Valley in San Francisco for quite a few years now. And you've had lots of cases involving different aspects of cyber stuff. In fact, I've been working with you on some of this. Just give us a sense of, for a lawyer that's in this space that you're in, how many clients do you end up dealing with a year? How many cases are there? What kind of stuff do you do every day as a lawyer?
That's, you know, it depends on the individual practice. For me, it's depended on a lot also on the year. There are certain years in which one be involved in a case that's complicated. Maybe it's a hacking case. Maybe it's a sort of large scale false advertising case. That may end up soaking up a third of your time for a year, maybe more. There, then one tends to have also, at least I do, a lot of shorter projects, one-offs, where you have clients with single issues, business or intellectual property issues, or issues with a single employee, perhaps. Those, you may have dozens of those in a given year. And then you factor in, if you do some contract writing, which I do, those projects, you can have dozens of them in a year as well. It pretty well depends.
Being a lawyer is really being a consultant, unless you're in-house at a company, right?
Yes. And even I think as an in-house lawyer, that as a general matter, that's what you are still as a consultant about the law.
Interesting. Okay. So now one of the things you said is you get cases that take a third of your time for a year. And, you know, by my calculation, that's like 600, 700 hours. And at whatever your hourly rate is, and we're not going to discuss your rates on the show, that can be a heck of a lot of money, right?
Well, there are a couple of assumptions that built into your statement, though, aren't there? One is that you're charging for every hour. The second one is that the client could pay even if you were. Legal services, I think, like most things, tend to be bought and sold as quantities. That oftentimes you're selling services in bulk. I don't know about other lawyers, but I know if I get anywhere close to a third of my time over a given stretch, the discounts become very steep. it becomes overwhelming for clients otherwise. Larger clients for whom you're doing a matter that big, that one would never undertake anything like that for a smaller company.
So when you talk about discounts, you know, I deal with a variety of law firms, on patent issues and on intellectual property issues and on, you name it. And
and you're one of the lawyers that I deal with occasionally. And this discount concept, I always thought when a lawyer tells you it's, you know, $1,000 an hour or whatever it is these days, that's that. But just don't let any other lawyers know you're telling us this. How much do you figure a typical company can cut off of the price of a law firm in terms of the hourly rates?
You know, it depends a lot. It depends. You know, if you're talking about a big firm lawyer who has lots of clients who can afford to pay very big firm rates, then good luck in that discussion as a smaller client. If, on the other hand, you're a large client who brings lots and lots of litigation matters that, you know, each individually can be worth several hundred thousand dollars or more in fees, then that's the kind of client for whom a lawyer might, you know, a partner managing a team of other people might start to offer quite significant discounts. You sometimes, although pure retainer engagements, as we call them, are rare, and that's when you pay a lawyer effectively to be available to handle certain matters. Though those are rare, you know, it does happen that you have law firms will be on contract to do, for example, all of the sales-related agreements that a company might have. And in those cases, also, you're going to see more significant discounts based upon the, you know, a very consistent amount of work. So it depends. If you're a small company, you're better off looking, I think, for, you know, to begin talking with smaller law firms. If you're looking for sort of a better bang for the buck, a lot of folks who work in larger, more complicated settings will, you know, eventually step off to do their own thing. They're doing the same very high quality work, just in a different setting with much less overhead. And they probably want a little more flexibility. And so their rates come down commensurate with that. And they can also be more creative with their pricing in terms of doing fixed fees, package deals, and all those things.
This is incredibly complicated, but I suspect that the rest of the law can get quite complicated as well. Is that right?
It can be as complicated as you want to make it. Small company, typically you're looking to make the law less complicated on an ideal day. But the law, even with regards to issues that appear simple on their face, the law can be almost as complicated as you or your lawyer or the other party's lawyer is willing to make it.
Well, as I said in other segments, right, there's ways things have always been and there's the ways they end up being. And when the difference in the latter state is significant, that drives change. And the complexities of doing anything in the legal world are just that. But if I look at laws, contracts, documents that are this, you know, of this whole legal world we live in, it reads like software to me. So the policy work beginning now, I would say, in the cyber industry, I think has fascinating implications on all of this longer term. And we're probably talking in terms of decades, but I can't see a long-term future where you have to, by hand, read all these documents and correlate them together when they're really just if this, then that.
So there are, we'll call them digital contracts, right? So-called smart contracts that embed standard clauses in contracts. Part of the problem is in performance of those agreements, you actually have to do what the agreement says, which means you actually have to know what it means if you're running a business or the group in a business that's executing on that contract.
So that's why I think it's going to be a multi-decade thing, right? This is the digital bill of materials world, right? Which we're just in software supply chain world at the core of it, and the working groups run by, you know, the U.S. government and the acronym organizations everybody knows. We are all just trying to work through how this all knits together on the big scale. But myself and some others, I think we can see pretty well how it works. Now, I couldn't tell you a lot of the details, but what will happen is the contract you sign will be tied to your manufacturing, for example. So you will know as you are making things that those things comply with the contract. Because the way we're doing it right now is we talk to each other and we hope we understand and we check every once in a while.
The way it happens now is engineers spend a great deal of time making sure they meet specifications. And there's testing processes and all of these things that verify that it is what it's supposed to be. And there's lots of audits and so forth. And then there are compensations for failures to do that. But the sort of
And you do a lot of that by hand, right?
Well, so I don't know a way to do that engineering not by hand. You know, we talked to Alex from Proper Parts before, and he knows a great deal about many manufacturing processes. You have to pick the process that can actually meet the specs. You have to be able to meet the cost requirements, and you have to know what those things are. And then once you do that, you know, there's still a lot of skill and knowledge in building the mold and keeping the processes at the right temperature and so forth. And while a lot of that's automated, there's science that goes behind it. There are changes in materials and weather and climate and humidity and all sorts of things in the environment that you have to adapt to. And it's just more complicated than what we can automate and requires knowledge.
Yes, but we've gone through these conversations in the debunk working groups, right? You know, the exactly those scenarios. You know, I'm taking, you know, a meltable solid that I'm getting from a supplier. I'm running it through a manufacturing process to make catheters for medical use and so forth. I'm already doing all the things you said right now. Plant engineers, God bless them, everyone. They're doing amazing things today to do all those things, stay in compliance. But, you know, you can do all those things. And that's just data. And that data can plug automatically directly in. So you're not having to do an audit, but you're seeing that that batch does, in fact, comply with this contract, which complies with that regulation all in real time.
So I'm going to disagree with you. One of the rare times I disagree with you. I do not believe that we are anywhere near the point where artificial intelligence is going to get close to being able to do the sorts of things that experts actually do to make that manufacturing process work.
That's not what I'm saying, though. I'm saying comparing the results of all that engineering and all that human expertise in real time, as opposed to, you know, to our topic here, you know, pulling in the lawyers.
The cost of building that mature process is very high, so that you can only really do that for very large scale, highly repetitive operation. The difficulty in finding the right measurement technique to not unduly disturb the thing that you're executing on is not something that's likely to be automated for the foreseeable future.
That I agree with, but then doing the actual, you know, validation, verification in a legal context, you know that at not the design, but the operations. You know, when the bloody thing's running, do I have to stop at every 6 months or every 6 days to check to see if it's working, and then call up the lawyers, you know, to our topic today, to make sure the contract reads that way? Or can I tie that data together?
The contract work usually happens up front. And once you're in the manufacturing process, all the contract stuff has been specified for that process. Very rarely today do you encounter something where you have a new manufacturing process that requires anything substantial to check against the actual contract, as long as you're meeting the thresholds, you know, accuracy and precision and timeliness and material requirements, you're fine. That's not something that the contracts are going to get involved in. That's already largely mitigated. The other side of this, you know, Hank is talking about lawyers as sort of independent consultants and about the ability to negotiate on price and all these things with attorneys. And a notion that small companies should have small attorneys firms is directly contrary to the claimed desires of the startup world, where people say, oh, you need one of these big law firms behind you so you have that named law firm to give them confidence. And I find the named law firms giving confidence to be very expensive and problematic. And I don't believe that they do any better than the small specialized law firms, in my experience.
I can't disagree with that.
You can try.
No, I've been there. Yeah, you know, I got nothing bad to say about the big firms worked with in the past, but I don't know that it was worth the investment at the time.
Yeah, and then there are the law firms that'll give you deals that they'll give to small companies. Usually it's one of the newer attorneys that isn't yet a partner that needs to get a book of business in place. And they're usually willing to do all sorts of things along those lines until they get their partnership, but the firm will only let them go so far. The other thing is, you're not actually getting the firm, you're actually getting that lawyer at that special rate. And if you need the rest of the firm, it's going to cost you, you know, enormous amounts.
And now a word from our sponsors.
This Sunday, the 4th of December, I'll be on KMBY TV at 6 p.m. If you watch, you can see what I look like when I talk. On Tuesday, December 6th at 9 a.m., we have the Angel to Exit Members Forum. You can sign up by joining the mailing list at angeltoexit.a2e.co. The following Tuesday, December 13th, we have our all.net cybersecurity community meeting. That's again starting at 9 a.m. To sign up, join the mailing list at all.net. That's all.net. I hope to see you at one of those events.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Now, on to our next service provider.
You are a diamond in the rough.
Perry Peterson, great to hear from you again. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing just fine.
There are new designs for nuclear power plants. So this new generation of nuclear is supposed to be based on physical spherical bodies that are placed into a containment in such a manner that they cannot melt down.
There are new fuel designs that are theoretically made to prevent just exactly what you described. So some of the new fuels for the new modular reactors are theoretically designed in a way that you won't have that result.
You keep using this T word, this theoretically. And when I hear people say, well, theoretically you won't die, but you might consider leaving a will.
Yes. Well, you know, there is the theory of gravity and the theory of evolution, and there's all the, they are theories, but when I use the word, I'm describing something that maybe hasn't been fully tested in the real world, but it's been modeled and, you know, in a laboratory and so on.
All right. So the thing is, eventually, actually, if we want to do it, we have to test it and get it well tested, well understood. And then the other thing is, for a car, you would want that fuel to be such that, you know, a mechanic, when reaching into the car, could lift it up in their hand. Presumably, to fuel a car, it's not going to be very much size or weight. It's going to be the size of a penny or something like that. So when you take it out, you probably, hopefully, you can put it in your hand without burning yourself.
Well, there is a new technology that I've read about recently where they have created a diamond battery using nuclear waste, and that the battery, again, in theory, generates electricity for hundreds of years. And I think that type of solution for cars could one day be viable.
More importantly, it may solve the nuclear waste problem. That is, you can take all the nuclear waste to the extent that you can convert it and turn it into something useful that's not dangerous, and then distribute it all over the world. Because after all, it originally was distributed all over the world. It's not like the nuclear stuff was new. We didn't create it. It always existed. We just gathered it together and filtered it out and purified it. So now if you can sort of depurify it and spread it back around, there's something interesting. Perry, we're going to have you back again and again. Perry Peterson, awesome. Well, there you go, Chris.
Right. One of the things I would like to see in my lifespan that may not be that likely, but I think is within grasp, is a battery like the size of a cell phone, for example, that I can carry around that has all the energy at my disposal I need for like a year. Why not? In the early 90s, when I first got on the internet, someone had put up a camera on their door so they could check when they were traveling for business. It's a great deal of debate in the early 90s about whether cameras on doorbells, for example, would be a thing. And at the time, I'm saying this is coming. And yeah, that community at the time is saying, you know, no, it's not. So similar to what Perry was talking about, energy usage, we've gone through conservation, we're terribly inefficient, we need to get better at that. However, the answer isn't found by turning off the lights. Answer is found in power and in cybers and so forth by the kinds of things that you and Perry are talking about. Keep moving the ball forward.
So I think the diamond battery as a future is one of those things where if it works, then for probably hundreds of years, energy, just put it in your house, put a couple of diamond batteries in your house and your house runs forever. The price of these diamonds obviously has to get low enough so that you can do that cost effectively. But once it's installed in your house, I mean, that's it. You don't need the power grid at all. You don't need the solar panels, probably. You don't need almost any of that other stuff. That's the sort of revolution. There's a revolution in storage as well. So this is diamonds are generation. There's a storage revolution going on that might be used in a lot of other circumstances. And there's, you know, the generation revolution, so, but it's distributed sourcing. So from an energy standpoint, all that's interesting. From a cyber standpoint, the idea that you now have a fully distributed source of power, that's a real game changer for the indefinite future.
You know, as I go around, you know, IoTing, you know, the houses I live in or boats I'm building or what, I think about this. Devices, I expect, this is one thing I expect to live to see should I make my normal span. You know, the devices all have their own batteries. Everything should store its own energy for its own purposes. And it should, you know, charge those by whatever means. But this whole hub and spoke idea that we have some whirling, you know, metal mass moving electrons back and forth that trickle down to devices and it all stops when it stops, that's not how any of this works, not in the long term.
The arc of technology is not guaranteed.
Right.
Nor do we know where that technology goes.
Right. But, you know, there are so many examples of things getting better over our lifetimes. I think that the biggest perspective on this, don't expect to live to see it all. I don't expect to live to see that. But over several hundred years, I think the forces go down that path. I think the sci-fi of today is dystopian angst. It's not futurism.
Now, onto our next service provider. I'm strong, I'm smart, I'm quick, and I'm tough. There's something amazing about Renaissance ladies, and I never have to give up half my stuff.
Carrie, welcome back. How you doing?
I'm good, Brad. Thank you. How are you?
Just fine. Anything fascinating since the last time we talked?
Well, you know, I think that with Mavericks, of course, we just got granted a certification to be the only company to be able to bring solar systems to the modular buildings for the school districts in California.
And that was interesting. We talked about that before. You're building housing for the teachers because obviously on a teacher's salary, you can't afford to get anywhere near working in a school in Silicon Valley or anywhere like that.
Yeah, that's housing. So for the teachers themselves. This is to bring solar and EV charging to the modular buildings on school properties.
Right. So the schools themselves are using modular buildings. They've done this for a long time. They used to bring in trailers, basically, right?
They're going to do that, but we're going to be able to put solar into those buildings and also EV charging. So we have that. And then we're also, we just brought out of escrow a couple of land pieces with Soledad as a city for one to build what we'll call smart gas stations or truck stations. stops of the future. And we are right now in conversations with both Chevron and Phillips 76 to be our partner to bring in the clean diesel and our leasers actually too. So
are you putting electric charging stations in as well?
Yep. Yes. Duracell. Yep.
Yeah. It's one of the big problems is having enough charging stations. The other one is rapid charging, but that's a battery technology that's dramatically, you know, changing these days. So that's getting much faster, yes. Right? And how far the cars can go. There's one car I understand that's been over 1,000 miles on a charge at least one time. Mm-hmm. So it's a nice little demonstration that, you know, that'll get better than gas powered and then recharging in a few minutes. All right. So that's all in your future. The other thing is you've done advisory work for Angel to Exit and for some of our clients. And I really think it's important to talk about the sort of advice and assistance that you give companies when they come to you for help.
Okay. Well, usually I say that I'm more of a strategist. So, and it's more about, you know, raising money is fine, but, you know, making money is better, I always say. So, you know, how to put them, position them into market, get them collaborative partners or maybe advisors too, but also money that understands what the company's trying to do and what their next steps need to be. So when I advise, I'm usually trying to source just about anything that the company needs. And that could be, you know, other executive types, or that could be board members or advisors or money or a partnership or, you know, another piece of IP that they don't have or a good collaboration opportunity because they have something that's great, but it's not great enough to really position itself in market. So those are kind of the things I do. It's basically what I do for myself with my companies, and I have for over 40 years. It's really building a company around innovation ideas and whatever else.
So one of the things we talk about in that context is connections. Yeah. And you seem to have and be able to rapidly build fantastic connections. And I want to take you back in time to when you first started in business. And I realize that memory fades. But
yes.
My understanding from talking to you before was that the first company you got funded based on just a discussion with somebody the first time out.
Well, my first company was when I dropped out of college my first semester and I started a company. I raised about $500,000 in the 70s, which was a hard thing to do. Then I moved eventually to Japan and built markets and stuff there. But my company that I currently have, yes, it was just predicated on one phone call. Before I filed the company as a registered corporation with Kansas, I had $250,000, but no bank account even for the company because I didn't have an EIN yet.
So, was it cash or what?
Check, but you know that, and in that company, we raised about $3.7 million at the friends and family level. We never went to Angel and we never went to VC. So it was all my network of friends, well, you know, collaborators, whatever, what have you.
Yeah. You know, friends is, besides friends, a lot of it was just people you worked with before, right?
That's
once people start to work with you and get to know you, they say, Carrie's great.
Yes.
You know, we're gonna work with her. Oh, you need $500,000? Sure. You know, because the last thing I did with you made me $40 million out of two. So here's another half.
That's
no problem at all. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in this world, those connections are tremendous. And it's very difficult to find people that have and can make those connections so easily. So tell us your secret. How is it that you are able to connect with people, you know, better, faster, more effectively, and so forth?
I don't know if I'm capable of doing that, but I think that the thing that I do is I go in and I work as hard and I try to do as much, if not more, as everybody else that's on that team, right? I'm working as hard as they are. I think that people see that I'm going to try and make whatever needs to happen, whether I have the resources or I have within my network, even if I have to go out my network, I'll source my entire network to find that next solution or whatever it is that is needed. So that's kind of how I work.
So hard work, being smart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being nice, because I've never seen you be mean to anybody.
I'm not mean. No.
Well, but it's not just being nice. It's also your behaviors. Your communication style is always nice. It's always positive. It's always affirmative. And you're always trying to help. And we've had situations where entrepreneurs did not like what you were doing and didn't feel as if it was effective.
That's
but
true.
They never said, I don't like her.
Right. Well, and too, I mean, you know, there are times when I can help and when I can't, you know, I lean into certain sectors, I would say. There are certain areas that I like more than others. So I like technology, I like energy, and I like the medical world. And I've worked extensively in all of those. I started in fashion, but I've worked in a lot of different sectors, from cosmetics to sports nutrition to, you know, diabetic medicine, bariatrics, I guess is what you'd call it, to medical devices. My company did a seizure detection analysis and the onset, you know, predictive capabilities. I've worked in biometrics. I've worked in...
So we can reasonably call you a Renaissance woman.
I've worked in a lot of different things. Yeah.
You're going to deny the title Renaissance woman?
I don't know about that. I think that that's somebody who's very well-rounded. So of course I have played two instruments in the past. So I like to cook. I have a lot of interests, but I don't know if I'm a Renaissance woman. I wouldn't say that I'm an innovator, but I'm a great supporter of that. I'm on the other side of that. You know, if somebody has a great idea in my mind, if it makes sense, I can scale it at a high volume and then kind of bring it back and say, okay, what's the first step? So I don't shy away from things just because I don't have knowledge, talent, or ability in those sectors. But I would say that cybersecurity...
Okay. That's a great statement, right? Just because I don't know anything, I don't have any skills or anything like that, that doesn't mean I can't do it, right?
Exactly. Well, that's kind of my attitude. I think that that is kind of what might draw some people to me. Like, I don't know much about cybersecurity, but it doesn't mean that I couldn't find an interest in it and then figure it out, right? FinTech, SaaS, those are areas that, you know, I've had exposure to, but would not be a strong suit to me, maybe. So.
But your job is not the technology anyway.
It isn't. Nope. That's right.
That's right. Your job is connection and communication and understanding and business decision making and business strategy and all that other stuff that you need to run the business, not the technology that's behind it.
That's right. Although I do know how to source to build technology and, you know, to find.
Well, and you have some patents in your portfolio. You know, you're not exactly a technical dummy. You know, but
That's true. But if I let me put it this way, my criteria is if it looks like it makes sense, it looks like a viable opportunity. I like the team. That's probably the first, because, you know, people are harder to work with than you think they are. And you don't know until you start down a path with them. And I've had to undo some pretty knotted situations that were not great. And, you know, that's something that you want to have to do when you go into a company. But, you know, I've been hired by stockholders to go on seat boards and CEOs. So it
sounds like fun to me.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe to you, Fred, but.
A good time at Bow. A good time at Bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time at Bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.